May it please the court, counsel. My name is Britta Cruz. I'm a deputy state public defender. My registration number is 41572, and I represent Mr. Steve Gordon.
Counsel, you might want to move that microphone closer to you there.
Thank you. Oh, much better. As I said, I represent Mr. Steve Gordon, who's present with us today. For purposes of today's argument, I intend to focus on just the first issue, which is the suppression issue, unless, of course, this court has questions about either of the other two issues, which I'd be happy to answer. Also, just by way of notice, I do intend to reserve at least 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. As our Supreme Court observed in Haley, travelers on the roads of Colorado may reasonably expect that a police officer may stop them for violations of the traffic law. They do not, however, expect to be detained and their vehicle searched once the reason for the stop has concluded. And in fact, the law requires that once the purpose for the initial stop has been resolved, any further detention or questioning of the driver whatsoever constitutes an illegal seizure in violation of the driver's constitutional rights to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, unless justified by reasonable and articulable suspicion of a crime. Here, Mr. Gordon's constitutional rights were violated when, after the investigation into the very minor traffic infractions for which he was purportedly stopped had been resolved, the officers did not permit he and his family to continue on their way, but instead persisted in detaining and questioning them about matters unrelated to the traffic stop and without reasonable or articulable suspicion that Mr. Gordon was engaged in any criminal activity.
When you say he persisted, the officer persisted, didn't the trial court below find that once the documents were returned to Mr. Gordon, the officer said he was free to leave?
Yes, Your Honor. There
and
is
then,
how.
And then the officer said, oh, may I ask you a few more questions? And Mr. Gordon, I guess, turned around and came back and answered the questions. Where is the evidence of persistence or anything that was coercive in what the officer did at that point?
Your Honor, the issue before this court actually happens well before the officers return the documents. What they're supposed to do upon concluding a traffic investigation is return those documents immediately. The law is quite clear. The officers don't get to engage in any further questioning or discussion with the driver. They must simply let the driver go. And so that's what I mean by persisting. The trial court made a specific finding that the officers had already run the license check, warrants, all that. The traffic investigation was over, and yet the officer did not return Mr. Gordon's documents to him. He kept on to them. He questioned Mrs. Gordon. He questioned Mr. Gordon. And he questioned Mrs. Gordon again. And those are all questions unrelated to the minor 5 miles over speeding for which he was pulled over and the obstructed license plate. These were questions about their travel itinerary, which both officers had been essentially interrogating Mr. Gordon and his wife about for some minutes up to this point. The officers are not permitted by law to hold on to a driver's documents until they can wait and establish reasonable suspicion. Once the traffic investigation is concluded, those documents must be returned and Mr. Gordon and his family must be permitted to proceed on their way. Now, what happened here, as Your Honor noted, the officers held on to these documents. As I said, they questioned both Mr. and Mr. Gordon multiple times before returning the documents.
Counsel, can I ask a question on that point? Do you know how much time elapsed between the time the officer confirmed the insurance and the time the officer returned the insurance documents?
Defense counsel attempted to establish that fact at the suppression hearing, and officers testified, we don't know, we weren't keeping track of the time, and so that was not clear on the record. But what the case law makes clear is it doesn't matter if it's a few minutes or a few hours. The moment the investigation is concluded, the driver of the vehicle must be allowed to proceed on his way. The officers can't even ask, you know, how about those Broncos? Your wife looks lovely today. Because these officers are in uniform, their lights are flashing. A reasonable person is not going to feel able to leave until their documents are returned to them. And so even this questioning about their travel itinerary exceeds the purpose of the stop and constitutes an illegal seizure.
Doesn't this case turn on when the officer said you're free to leave, and Mr. Gordon walked away, and then the officer renewed his questioning or asked if he could ask more questions, and the issue becomes whether Mr. Gordon returned voluntarily or involuntarily?
With all due respect, Your Honor, no. The issue, that is part of the issue, but the true issue in this case, when the illegal detention really began, is when the officers had validated all of Mr. Gordon's documents, the traffic investigation has concluded, and instead of returning those documents to Mr. Gordon, they questioned Mrs. Gordon, Mr. Gordon, Mrs. Gordon again, and Mr. Gordon again, and then at that point, they returned the documents.
Is it your position that findings were made by the trial court below that support what you just described to us? I don't think I saw that in the court's findings.
Yes, the court did make a specific factual finding of when the checks of the warrants, the license, the registration, all that had been completed.
And the proof of insurance, because that seemed to be a slightly delayed matter.
Right, Your Honor, and that's why my brief, the illegal detention starts at that point once they have the insurance information. The officers looked at the insurance card. They did no further investigation. It's just a facially valid document. And at that point, the traffic stop had concluded.
So when Mrs. Gordon, I guess it was, got the insurance out of the glove compartment and handed it to the other officer who asked that, your position is that's when the detention should have ended?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and you're saying that the record would show that the papers, the other papers, the registration and proof of, and the license, were not handed back until some further questions were asked, and only then were they told they were free to leave.
That's correct.
And the questions that were asked from the time the insurance was looked at by the officer, the time they were given back the registration, is the illegal detention.
Correct.
And the record you say supports that.
Correct. And I do have the record citations in my brief. Trial court made a specific finding. The officer's testimony was very clear on when the documents were returned. But,
and that time period that you just described is when the illegal detention began. It seems like a very short time between the time the time when the officer confirmed the insurance and gave back the insurance information. It wasn't, I mean, most of the statements at issue happened before then and then after that. So even if we agree with you that it was legal for that short time, how could it possibly matter?
It matters a great deal, Your Honor. Up until that point, the statements of Mr. and Mrs. Gordon were entirely consistent. And the officers, once they obtained the insurance information, we don't know how long it took them, but the record is clear that it was enough time for Officer Collette to question my client, and then question my client's wife, and then question my client again. That's not permitted under the law, and the law is quite clear on this point. And I would point the court to our Colorado Supreme Court cases, Redinger, Rodriguez. They say there's no justification for continued questioning. These drivers cannot be subject to further delay. And perhaps the most powerful statement of that is a case discussed in Brandon in Redinger, which is McSwain, a 10th Circuit case. And in that case, they say once it's determined that the driver is authorized to drive the vehicle, then he must be permitted to go on his way. It's not even permissible for the officers to ask for identification. They're not even allowed to ask one more question. And
they did by that time in our case have inconsistent versions of their travel arrangements from the Gordons, correct?
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. As I pointed out in my brief, the officers were only aware of four facts. And it's very important that this court understand the timeline here because the Attorney General was not entirely accurate in his description of when certain facts were known. Only four facts were known at this time, that the Gordons were traveling from Boston to San Francisco to look for car trailers for Mr. Gordon's brother's auto body business. Two, that they were returning via I-70 as opposed to I-80, which the officer believed was a more direct route from San Francisco to Boston. Three, and perhaps this is the purported inconsistency Your Honor is recalling, is there was some indication that Mr. Gordon said that they would stop in Chicago on their way home, whereas Mrs.
The reverse.
the reverse. And Mrs. Gordon said they might stop on the way back. However, as I pointed out in my brief, that is not even inherently inconsistent.
And something about going to Los Angeles. Unable to go to Los Angeles.
Well, Your Honor, that's the exact fact, and I'm very glad you brought it up, because that is not known to the officers at the time. That is a product of the illegal detention. They detained Mr. and Mrs. Gordon beyond the purpose of the stop, and that is the information that they obtained from that. And frankly, once again, Your Honor, as I argued in my brief, not even that alleged inconsistency will rise to the level of reasonable and articulable suspicion, because what makes this case so unique is that the officers here never offered any explanation for why these alleged inconsistencies were indicating that a crime was occurring. All they said was, this appeared weird.
What do we do with the Garcia decision from our court, which says inconsistent explanations by the driver and the passenger in that case did provide probable cause of reasonable suspicion to continue the interrogation?
And Your Honor, as I point out in my brief, Garcia is very distinguishable and never held as a matter of law that mere inconsistencies rose to the level of reasonable suspicion. If Your Honors will remember, in Garcia, we had a lot of inconsistencies and very substantial ones, and the officer in that testimony...
More inconsistencies than we had in this case, and more serious ones.
Significant. And we had an officer who's trained in drug investigations actually testify about what it was about these inconsistencies that made him believe that a drug crime is occurring. Mm-hmm. Notably, in our case, we had no such testimony. The officers just said that these things stood out to them or appeared weird.
So you're not arguing that inconsistencies cannot provide probable cause, but the inconsistencies in this case did not rise to the level of Garcia.
Right. I do understand that the nature of the totality of the circumstances test allows individually innocuous factors to add up to reasonable suspicion. But I would point this court to the Tenth Circuit opinion in Woods. Innocent factors will not add up to a suspicious conglomeration unless there's a concrete reason for such an interpretation. And here there was no concrete reason for such an interpretation, because the officers never provided any evidence or testimony of what it was about these inconsistencies that indicated any crime was occurring. Essentially, they had an unarticulated hunch, and they held Mr. Gordon and his family in the hopes that evidence of a crime would turn up. And our court, Rodriguez, has declaimed that tactic on behalf of the officers, and that contributes to the tainting of the illegal seizures throughout the so-called consensual acts that followed. That's part of the purpose and flagrancy of the misconduct in this case, which the trial court explicitly found these officers were incredible on numerous points, that they weren't out there doing traffic enforcement like they claimed. But the officers never did explain what it was about these facts that were suspicious. And
so, Kim, on that point, what do you have? It seems like your opponent is saying part of the reason perhaps why we might be missing some of this testimony, some of the court's findings, because you didn't make this precise argument below. You made a different one.
We preserved this argument in the suppression motion.
Did you make it at the hearing?
We presented evidence at the hearing, and the trial court made a finding on this point. They said that it was just enough time to conduct the traffic stop. However, I would remind this court that it's the state's burden to prove that the stop was constitutional. There was no warrant here. And so to the extent that there are facts missing, that will be weighed against the state in this case. And I would like to point out the 10th Circuit case, I believe in Simpson, where the court said, you know, yes, weird or inconsistent travel itineraries may contribute to reasonable suspicion. However, not if those weird aspects are only weird because a reasonable person or the officer himself would have made different choices. And that's all we have here, is the officers indicating that, well, we would have done things differently if we were doing the same trip. And Americans and our citizens, we have a constitutional right to travel where we please, how we please. And that's really what this case is about. To base reasonable suspicion on these facts here would be, to borrow the language of the 10th Circuit in Wood, tantamount to subjecting the traveling public to virtually random seizures and arbitrary exercise of police power, which the Constitution doesn't permit. If your honors don't mind, I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Counsel, I have one question on the sufficiency of evidence. I'm sorry I have to ask this, though. The other 20 packages or so that were seized from the truck were admitted into evidence at the trial. Is that correct?
The unopened bundles, that's correct, Your Honor.
They were. So when the prosecutor opened one in the closing argument, that had already been admitted into evidence.
Right. He altered the already admitted evidence, correct. Thank you, Your Honor. I will reserve the remainder of my time.
Good morning. May it please the court. Kevin McReynolds, bar number 40978, on behalf of the people. I think Judge Navarro pointed out a lot of the confusion in how to deal with the appellate issue is caused by the fact that the primary argument on which defendant rests was not made below. The argument that somehow there is a bright line rule that the instant an insurance proof of insurance document is produced, that from that instant the traffic stop must end and that any additional questioning is an illegal seizure, was not presented below. Now, in the reply brief and again here, the defendant has pointed out that, well, we did have something in the written motion that had something to do with that issue, but that isn't enough to preserve. And the case People v. Samuels 228 P. 3rd at 238 is on this point. It says that if the fact that there's a cryptic boilerplate statement in the written motion, if that argument isn't presented at the argument when the trial court has heard all of the evidence, then it's not preserved, and it's a suppression issue, and suppression issues are treated differently. While many issues can be raised for the first time on appeal and will be considered for under plain error review, suppression issues are different, and they're different for two reasons. The first is that the burden is on the people. This is more than a mere waiver. By not presenting the argument below, the people never had the burden to rebut that argument. The people never had an opportunity to rebut that argument. And the other reason is that in suppression hearings, the trial court is the fact finder. The trial court is the one who has to weigh the evidence and consider it. And here there was no opportunity for there to be any development of evidence about that issue. And I think this case illustrates why that might be important. In this case, the proof of insurance card is handed over by Mrs. Gordon after she's made the inconsistent statement about the travel itinerary regarding Chicago. And at this point, the fellow officer had already heard the Los Angeles statement, which Agent Collette, who was speaking to Mrs. Gordon, didn't himself know about yet, but under the fellow officer rule, which Pickford does apply in reasonable suspicion cases.
That's just like, and that's a lot of facts. I want to try the chronology. The defendant's wife didn't refer to the failure to go to Los Angeles until after she had given the proof of insurance card. Is that right?
While she's, going to the timeline, Agent Collette was the one who was running the license and registration. Mr. Gordon hadn't been able to find his proof of insurance, and so he checks those, and he comes out of the car. Now, while that's going on, while he's doing that check, the other agent, I think his name was Jacobson, but I'm forgetting, was speaking to Mr. Gordon, and Mr. Gordon had mentioned Los Angeles and Las Vegas to him. Now, then Agent Collette goes to Mrs. Gordon. This is the first time anybody's talked to Mrs. Gordon, and she's looking for the proof of insurance. He asks her about the itinerary, and he notices the discrepancy about Chicago. Now, I would suggest that in terms of what did the officers collectively know at that point, they knew that she was saying an itinerary that did not mention Las Vegas and Los Angeles, and Mr. Gordon had. But if you were to ignore the fellow officer rule, the point is that after that, the fact that we didn't have this argument below matters, because we don't know what amount of time police officers standardly take to check to verify if a proof of insurance is valid. We don't know that because this argument wasn't raised below. We didn't have any statement about whether especially in a case like this where the vehicle is registered in the proof of insurance or in a name that is not the name of any of the people present, and whether that amount of time that it would take to check the proof of insurance would have covered the rest of this allegedly illegal detention. And that is why this type of argument should not be addressed for the first time in
They did argue the role that any questions asked after the point where the agent said, may I ask you a few more questions, certainly are suppressible, right? They did argue that.
They did argue that on a different basis.
What questions were asked after Agent Collette looked at the proof of insurance and then handed it back to Mrs. Gordon or Mr. Gordon?
The questions before the consensual encounter began were simply for Agent Collette to try to clarify the apparent discrepancies in the stories. He'd heard a difference about Chicago himself at that point. He goes to speak to Mr. Gordon to make sure that he's not confused that there actually is a discrepancy, and not only gets that discrepancy, but gets to Los Angeles and Las Vegas. And having not heard anything about those cities, ask Mrs. Gordon directly.
No. So what I'm not trying to get is, what argument do you say was not made below that they're now making to us?
Their entire appeal is based on an argument that the instant the proof of insurance was handed over, that everything after that was an illegal detention. That argument was not made below. That is the basis of the entire appellate argument here, including their argument that it tainted the consensual encounter.
Okay. Assuming we entertain that argument, what is the state's position on whether the question after that was?
I think the trial court found that there was reasonable suspicion from these series of inconsistencies, and I think, as I've discussed a little bit, those inconsistencies did exist at the time that the proof of insurance was presented. And it becomes a marginal question of what is the least intrusive means of sort of dealing with that reasonable suspicion. And I think the least intrusive means were used here, and the officer was diligent here. What the officer did was, I think there's an inconsistency, but I'm not sure. So he goes to clarify that point, and he gets new inconsistencies about travel to one of the largest cities in the country, in Las Vegas, that had not been mentioned at all. He goes back to Mrs. Gordon, and she reconfirms how inconsistent this is.
And all this time he's holding on to the proof of insurance, or he's turning back the proof of insurance?
He does not return the documents until after he's spoken to Mrs. Gordon the second time.
And the state and the defendant's position, he should have returned them as soon as he looked at it and satisfied himself there was insurance. And your position is they had reasonable grounds to continue to ask questions after that because of the prior inconsistencies.
Yeah, that's not my position. That's also what the trial court found below, was that there was reasonable suspicion caused by this inconsistency. And I think you can impute the Los Angeles inconsistency at an earlier point through the fellow officer rule, because Mr. Gordon had been telling the other officer about, I ate dinner in Las Vegas and we went
but
to Los Angeles.
At that point, maybe I have the facts wrong, and if so, I apologize, but I thought at that point there was no word from defendant's wife about whether they had gone to Los Angeles. So how could there have been an inconsistency about whether they went to Los Angeles?
At the time that she was producing digging around and finding the proof of insurance to hand to Agent Collette, at that time she related her version of events, which had the Chicago inconsistency and had them traveling only to the San Francisco.
She didn't say only. She just said he went to San Francisco. She didn't exclude going anyplace else.
That's true, Your Honor, but she didn't mention any place else either. I think at this point I'll turn to what I think is the easiest way for the court to resolve the... I thought the preservation issue was an important point to bring up. What we have in the trial court's order are two distinct phases to this traffic stop. We have an investigatory stop, the traffic stop. It was a valid traffic stop. And then we have the consensual encounter. Now, the factual findings the trial court made were that the officer returned all the documents, gave him, let him off with a warning on traffic violations, shook his hand, said, you're free to go. He walked several steps back towards his car, then was asked whether he would return and answer more questions. He agreed to do so, came back, answered more questions, then consented to the search.
That was his mistake.
I'm sorry?
That was his mistake.
His mistake was taking $10,000 to smuggle contraband. But it's an objective test. At that point, the question is, from those objective facts, would a reasonable person have felt free to go? And this case is indistinguishable from the Supreme Court's case, Castaneda, where the exact same factual scenario played out. He was handed, the offender was handed back his documents, let off with a warning, told he was free to go, walked back towards his vehicle, asked if he would return and answer more questions, and he did. And in that case, the Supreme Court reversed the suppression order because that was so clearly a consensual encounter that it was objectively, a reasonable person would have felt free to leave. Therefore, it was a consensual encounter and outside the Fourth Amendment. The argument that defendants making on appeal is that the previous questioning had somehow tainted that. They rely on some distinguishable cases. I think one of them they relied on a lot of the opening brief was People versus Brandon. I think those cases, that case doesn't have any application here because what we have is a temporal and spatial distinction between when the investigatory stop ended and when the consensual encounter began. And that is in the handing back of the documents, the saying you were free to go, and allowing him to walk back towards his vehicle before asking him if he would answer more questions. Brandon,
I take it there was no testimony here that the officer also says, would you answer some more questions, and also said, you may not answer the questions if you don't want to. That second part was not, there's no evidence of that here.
There is no evidence of that second part, but there's also no evidence of that second part in Castaneda. I think that distinction makes that a completely separate encounter. It makes uneasier grounds for this court to resolve this matter because it is a separate encounter. It is and it's indistinguishable from case law, and that is grounds enough for this court to affirm. I'll turn very briefly to the sufficiency of the evidence.
I want to ask you one question. And nobody else in the room will hear your answer, just between you and me.
Okay.
Do you think this was really a traffic stop?
Absolutely. He was paced for speeding, and it was in the testimony that when they ran the plate, it came back as expired.
You don't have to explain your answer. Thank you.
To the sufficiency, there were 25 apparently identical bundles in this smuggling compartment. Two of them were opened, one by the officers on the scene who did a field test on test positive for THC. It looks like high-grade marijuana and tested as it. And the other was by the police laboratory and in each of those packages there were 2 pounds of marijuana found. The argument that the defendant made, you know, at closing arguments and again here is that, well, that's only proof of 4 pounds of marijuana, and you can't prove that the 23 other bundles contained even 1 pound. I think there are 3 different areas of evidence that each one of which would be sufficient for a rational juror to reasonably infer that there was at least 1 pound of marijuana in these identical packages. One was the drug expert, who was also Agent Collette at the stop, testified that he, from his training experience, looking at these bundles from the outside, when he first looked at them through the scope, he could tell that that was a packaging consistent with pot as opposed to other forms of narcotics. That would be enough grounds for a rational juror to reasonably infer that there was pot in all the containers. He also testified that viewing the bundles while sealed, you could see through them that the suspected marijuana substance inside them. Again, that would be enough information. And then in rebuttal closing, the prosecutor opened 2 additional bundles saying, well, these bundles are in evidence. Let's see if they look consistent. And he related back to the testimony and the other evidence. He related back to, this looks the same as the previously opened bundle from the police report. This looks the same as the previously opened bundle from Agent Collette. And this is really no different than, and the prosecutor didn't do anything that the jury couldn't have done. These exhibits were in evidence. They were going to go back to, they could go back to the jury, and the jury could have opened them themselves to say, huh, does this look the same as the things that the expert testified were pot? The police tested and said that were pot. And it's really no different than, I think there was a cell phone case last year where a drug dealer's cell phone had gone back to the jury. It had been admitted into evidence without any limitation. And the jury turned it on, found the battery still worked, it scrolled through and found incriminating text messages. That's opening a container of that is the admitted exhibit.
Counsel,
that's the same here.
I'm trying to interrupt. If we disagree with you that there was sufficient evidence of the greater amount, I think I noticed you asked us to enter judgment on the lesser amount.
I think that's
that, so you don't want a new trial on the greater amount, you just want us to enter judgment on the lesser amount?
I think that that would be one solution.
That's the only one you asked for, so I'm wondering if you're giving up the other one.
I would say that I didn't actually consult with the district attorney to ask them what their preference would be. I would say that there is no question that if you did find a problem with that fifth pound of marijuana, there's no question that the other 4 pounds were more than sufficient for the conviction in this case.
Thank you.
Although it's not much time, you do have 18 seconds. Peyton Manning can move it out in 18 seconds.
Well, please excuse me if I start rattling things off quickly. Just a few quick points. I want to lay to rest this idea of Los Angeles. I have double-checked the record over and over. That Los Angeles fact was not mentioned until after the point in which the Attorney General said it was. I also want to mention that these arguments the Attorney General is making about the sufficiency of the evidence and things that the jury could have done does not appear in his answer brief. This is being raised for the first time in an oral argument, and I see I've run out of my time. I ask that you reverse the trial court's order. Thank you.
Counsel, thank you for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and opinion will issue in due course.